laptop, but they're all coming tomorrow. But today there are no figures. Okay. So, yesterday, let me get rid of this thing. Oh, maybe I should leave it there? No. Okay. So, yesterday we wrote down the effective description of the weak interactions at low energy. And it came in this form, J mu plus J mu minus plus J mu 3 minus a parameter that I called SW squared, and the electromagnetic current came in here. And this term took a while to discover, but this term, as I said, was basically postulated in 1958. And so people looked at that and they said, well, obviously, this is something that arises from the exchange of a vector gauge boson that couples to this current J. And so we can derive a Lagrangian like that, or in particular this term, if I have a Feynman diagram that has here the current matrix element J minus, and here the current matrix element J plus, and here some boson, which is called the W boson for the weak interactions. And the W boson must be very massive so that when you integrate it out, you don't get a propagator, you just get a contact term. So this then immediately suggested that one could make a theory of the weak interactions by having a Young-Mills theory, just the same way that we make a theory of QCD and QED. There's only one problem, which is that Young-Mills theory normally requires that gauge bosons are massless. So let me remind you of how this works in electrodynamics. In electrodynamics, the field equation is this, where this is the field strength, and this is the electromagnetic current to which gauge bosons couple. I can write this out as del squared A nu minus d nu d lambda A lambda is equal to minus E j nu. So that should be a d. We're always free to choose the Lorentz gauge. So let's just choose the gauge for simplicity, where d lambda A lambda is equal to 0. And then this just becomes a massless wave equation whose source is the current. And so there's not much that's unambiguous about that. The quanta of this field, the photons, have to be massless. Now, and then the similar argument will go through in Young-Mills theory. So how do we solve that problem? Well, you folks, I think, have already studied this in your quantum field theory course. So let me just go through it quickly. The solution actually came from the theory of superconductivity, where similar equations apply. But it turns out that the photon field has a finite correlation length, which in this language would be a finite mass. And the way it works is the following. You introduce some additional field. So this theory has a U1 gauge symmetry corresponding to some phase rotation, for example, of the electron Schrodinger wave function. You introduce a scalar field that transforms under that symmetry. So let me just do this analysis in scalar electrodynamics. D mu phi star d mu phi, where d mu phi is d mu plus I e a mu on phi. Now I'd like to know what the field equation is. So to find out what the field equation is, it's just going to be this, where the current is the basically the term in the Lagrangian that has an a mu in it. Whatever a mu multiplies is the current. So that's equal to, can you read it from here? There isn't, maybe I should divide by e as well. I, if I differentiate on the a in here, I'm going to get d mu phi star times phi. If I differentiate on the A in here, I'm going to get minus phi star d mu phi. And there's one more term where I have this I e mu A squared. And when I differentiate on that, I'm going to get a term proportional to the A field. So this is the conserved current, which would be the electric charge current in this scalar field theory. And by using the Klein-Gordon equation in this theory, you can prove to yourself that it's a conserved current. Oh, maybe I should have added a mass term. That doesn't matter. Actually, what I'd like to do is not add the mass term, but I'd like to add a potential. And so the trick is going to be now that I'm going to add a potential. For example, one of these potentials, like minus mu squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth, that has its minimum at some position away from phi equals 0. And it has a minimum at a place where the symmetry is spontaneously broken. So this is now the second time in the course when I've invoked spontaneous symmetry breaking. But the results are going to be a little different from what we saw on Friday. OK, so now I sit at that minimum. I, at the minimum, phi is equal to v. Let me parameterize it, v over the square root of 2. In principle, phi can have any phase. So I could have a succession of minima, which would be characterized by an arbitrary phase. And these are all minima of the potential that looks like that. Yes?
Could that possibly be e squared on the fact that we divided by e also?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Excuse me.
Also on that same, there was an I squared that went into that, so is it a negative?
Sorry? No. I've just taken the, I'm writing the term e a mu j mu in the Lagrangian. So that I, and then here I get the complex conjugate. So it's positive.
Okay. I didn't realize the conjugate applied to the differential operator as well as the
field. Maybe I should just write this as e a is the e. Yes. So the complex conjugate, I'm sorry, applies to the whole thing. Otherwise, it isn't an issue. Yes?
I have a little confused because F mu mu is the energy moment tensor. And in cosmology, we partial with the energy moment tensor, we equal to zero. But here, we equal to the current half and spending.
Oh. Well, F mu nu isn't the whole energy momentum tensor. It's just the energy momentum tensor of the electromagnetic field alone. So then, I mean, typically in electrodynamics, you'll have the structure that the Lagrangian is the F mu nu squared, and then there'll be some coupling of A to a charge current, right? So there has to be some mechanism for, let's say, electrons to be sources of the electromagnetic field. And the way that works in electrodynamics is you put the electrons in here and the gauge field in here, and then this becomes Maxwell's. So such a thing would arise from a Lagrangian that looks like this. Yes?
How come the derivative with respect to A mu doesn't pick out anything from F mu nu, F mu nu?
Because that's the left-hand side of the equation.
No, on the over here where we have Lagrangian equals, and then we took J mu to be the derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to A mu.
Yeah, that's the question I was answering. Maybe I wasn't clear enough. So that's the field equation.
Right.
Okay. So the left-hand side of the equation is given by differentiating this. And the right-hand side of the equation is given by differentiating everything else. So maybe I should have put the right hand side. OK, so if I vary A in here, I'll get exactly this. If I vary A in the rest of it, I'll get the right-hand side. So you could say it's ambiguous what goes on the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And you know, in general relativity, people quarrel about that, you know, forever. Should dark energy go on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of Einstein's equation? but this is the way I'd like to. In any case, if I do this, I'm going to get that equation with J mu equal to this. Good. Okay, so now what I've done is that I've introduced the possibility that the U1 symmetry in this theory is spontaneously broken. And so now what you can do is just plug this into here, and then we'll get the better form of this equation. And what you see is that we're going to get J nu now. Now, in the vacuum state, phi is uniform. And it takes this value. So this term vanishes. This term vanishes. But this term is still around. And so we're going to get J nu equal to E squared EJ nu is equal to E squared V squared times A mu. But now you see we get a whole different equation. Oh, let me continue to work on this gauge for simplicity. Del squared A nu is equal to minus E squared V squared A nu. Ha! Well, that's a massive wave equation. And so by virtue of this spontaneous symmetry breaking, A has acquired a mass. So this mechanism takes place in a superconductor. It's basically the explanation for the Meissner effect in a superconductor, the fact that superconductors repel magnetic fields. But in principle, we can work it in any gauge theory. Yes?
Second last equation.
Oh, there should have been a nu here. So the indices all match. So we can work this in any kind of a Young-Mills theory. The general rule is that when we spontaneously break the gauge symmetry, we end up with a term in the current which is proportional to A mu. We now move that from the right-hand side of the equation to the left-hand side of the equation, and we get a massive field equation for that type of thing. So in the early 1960s, an illustrious group of people, Higgs, Kibble, Guralnik, Hagen, Brout and Englert, all wrote papers saying that this was a great mechanism for particle physics because it allows us to have massive vector bosons in particle physics. So in a sense, as a way of abbreviating that list, this mechanism is called the Higgs mechanism. And this field phi is called the Higgs field. So what I'd like to do now is to try and use this Higgs mechanism in order to construct theories of massive vector bosons that we can use to explain the weak interactions. Yes?
All right, so how does the potential on phi come about? Because we...
Well, that's a mystery. So I haven't specified that here. This is a general principle. In a real theory, I would have to actually derive this potential from physics. You're absolutely right. But let's leave that question aside for the moment. We'll come back to it, actually, not until Friday. Now, there's a lot of heavy theory that goes along with the Higgs mechanism. And I think in the spirit of this course, I'm not going to describe it. But there's one important point about the Higgs mechanism that I would like to make. We started out with a massless photon here. And a massless photon has 2 degrees of freedom, left and right-handed polarization. However, a massive vector boson has 3 degrees of freedom. And you can see that because if it's massive, you can always go to its rest frame. In its rest frame, it's a spin 1 object, J equals 1. And J equals 1 has 3 states, namely J3 equals 1, 0, or minus 1. So somehow, in the process of doing what I did, this gauge boson has managed to steal an extra degree of freedom from somebody else in the theory. Now, a nice way to represent that is to choose a different gauge from the one that I chose over there. And the nice gauge to choose, so remember the gauge action. The gauge symmetry acts on phi as a local phase rotation. So we can now choose a gauge where phi is real everywhere. Then, in that gauge, the gauge condition is that phi doesn't have any imaginary part. So I can just write it like this. And I've used the gauge symmetry to remove a degree of freedom, namely the degree of freedom to rotate phi. Now if you plug this into here, you get the following Lagrangian. You get your the f mu nu squared, of course, can always be written like this. The kinetic term here becomes just 1/2 d mu sigma squared, and this extra term, 1/2 e squared, it's actually b plus sigma squared a squared, and then the potential for sigma. So this is a theory of what will turn out to be, when you minimize this potential, a massive real scalar field sigma, a massive vector field A, for which the mass term is this one, e squared v. There's some interactions between v and sigma, but frankly, they're quite innocuous. And there are no massless particles in this theory. You'd expect a massless particle on the basis of the considerations I gave on Friday. That if you have a continuous symmetry, then if you wiggle the expectation value of that symmetry in the symmetry direction, you should get a Goldstone boson, which is massless. What's happened is that we've gauged away the Goldstone boson. The Goldstone boson turned out to be a pure gauge degree of freedom. And that degree of freedom has reappeared as the third component of the massive A field. So pictorially, the A field ate the Goldstone boson, and it became massive. OK? So if you're interested much more in the formalism of the Higgs mechanism, you can look at in chapters 20 and 21 of my textbook. But I think we're done with the formalism. I'd now like to apply this. Yes?
Sorry if you've said it already. Could you say why you can't just write the Lagrangian with a mass effect boson to start with, why we need a Higgs mechanism? To get a mass effect.
Oh. Well, of course, there are big problems when you write down any vector field. Because the natural thing you would write for a vector field is the commutation relations AK mu AK nu dagger is equal to G mu nu times delta of K minus K. So this is the natural thing you would write whenever you write down a relativistic vector field. However, this equation is a total disaster, because g mu nu has some components that are positive and some components that are negative. So whenever you have positive here, you're fine. You have ordinary creation and annihilation operators. But whenever you have negative here, you have either negative metric, negative probability, some very bad thing. And so it has to be a gauge theory in order that this extra degree of freedom that does bad things, in this case the time-like polarization with negative probabilities, can be gauged away. So once you insist that it has to be gauged away, we have to be in this framework. OK. Now, this Higgs mechanism becomes much more interesting when you apply it to a non-abelian gauge theory. And so let me now work out the simplest example of that. What I'd like to do is to take an SU2 gauge theory with a Higgs boson in the spin 1 representation. So I'm going to have a real valued Higgs field with three components, 1, 2, 3. And let me write down the analog of scalar electrodynamics for this theory. where the covariant derivative acting on this field is d mu phi, and then it's in the adjoint representation. So this, as we learned last week, is the covariant derivative in the adjoint representation. So the structure constants of SU2 are just epsilon ABC. Now, I'm going to do the same trick that I did before. I'm going to assume that V has a minimum somewhere away from the origin. So the minimum of V corresponds to phi A. Let me write it like this. This is called the vacuum expectation value of phi A. V, and then this is a vector in the space 1, 2, 3. It points in some direction. Let me just completely arbitrarily point it in the 3 direction. Once again, we have a manifold of degenerate vacuum states corresponding to this vector pointing in any direction. They're all physically equivalent. I've chosen that one for convenience. OK, now let me plug this into the kinetic energy term for the Higgs field. So this becomes the d mu phi is 0. So all that's left is g epsilon abc, a mu b. C gets set equal to 3, and a factor of v appears here. Now we have to reduce this formula. A nice way to do that is to use the identity epsilon abc, epsilon ade is equal to delta bd delta ce minus delta BE delta CD. So in this case, C and E got set equal to 3. So this is equal to 1 half GV squared times A mu A, A mu A, minus A mu 3, A mu 3. Which is to say, we get masses not for all 3 gauge bosons, but just for 2 of them. And the third one remains massless. So this is the kind of thing that typically happens when you have the Higgs mechanism in a non-abelian gauge theory. There's some geometrical structure that causes some but not all of the vector bosons to get masses. The structure here is actually pretty easy to understand. So basically, we have this three-dimensional space. SU2 is the same group as SO3. So there are axes 1, 2, and 3. A1 gauges the symmetry of rotation about the 1 axis. A2 gauges the symmetry of rotation about the 2 axis. And H3 gauges the symmetry of rotation about the 3 axis. Now we stuck this Higgs vacuum expectation value as a big vector that points in this direction. So it spontaneously breaks the symmetry of rotation about 1 and 2, but it preserves the symmetry of rotation about 3. So these two guys get mass, and this one doesn't. Very simple. If the symmetry corresponding to that gauge boson is not broken, the gauge boson doesn't get a mass. Well, this is now, if you think about it, incredibly cool. Because now we have a theory with two massive bosons and one massless boson. And for the massive bosons, we can take linear combinations like this. And we can consider these guys to have electric charge, or rather a charge under the rotation about the 3 direction. So these are the eigenstates of angular momentum about the 3 direction. So we have two charged massive vector bosons and one massless vector boson. Let me write A is equal to A3. So this is actually a unified theory of electromagnetic and weak interactions. We could just identify this with the photon. That's massless. We identify these guys with the W bosons. If we couple them to the right thing and integrate them out, we'll generate this diagram, and we'll generate at least this part of the weak interaction curve. And this theory was actually proposed as a theory of weak and electromagnetic interactions by George Ion Glashow in 1972. It's certainly the simplest unified theory of weak and electromagnetic interactions. And I think it's worth understanding just to see how this Higgs mechanism works. It is unfortunately not the right theory, and one of the reasons it's not the right theory is that it can't explain this term. So it doesn't have any neutral currents. In fact, Georgia and Glashow wrote their paper just before the discovery of neutral currents. So it was quickly wiped off the map. And instead, now I have to tell you what the right theory is. So any questions about this before we go on? OK. So the right theory was actually written down somewhat earlier by Glashow, Weinberg, and Salon. And actually, Glashow wrote his paper before the Higgs mechanism was understood. And it's a great paper. You've got to read it. In this paper, he says, we have a symmetry between the W boson, which is very massive, the W boson and the photon. The W boson is very massive. The photon is massless. We must ignore this difficulty. That's what he says in the paper. After the discovery of the Higgs mechanism, Weinberg and Salam then showed how to embed that in a Higgs structure. And it gave the model that I'm now going to describe. So the model is based on not a simple gauge group, as in the previous example, but a product gauge group, SU2 cross U1. So there are going to be four gauge bosons, three in here, one in here. If you have a product gauge group, you don't have to have a single unified coupling for all the interactions. You can assign a separate value of the coupling constant to these guys and a separate one to this guy. And so that's the structure I'm now going to build. Yes?
When you talk about a product gauge group, what kind of a product are we talking about? Cartesian tensor?
A tensor product. That is, I'm going to have fields that transform under this and separately under this. So the gauge group is just the tensor product of these two big groups. So let me be very explicit about that. I'd like to introduce a Higgs field, phi alpha. And this thing will be in the two-dimensional or spinner representation of SU2. And I'm going to assign it a charge under the U1, and I'm going to assign it charge plus a half under the U1. So it's a complex number which is rotated by this phase, by a phase with the charge 1/2. And it's also a two-component spinner that transforms under SU2. And if you like, I can write that as phi plus phi 0. That's just notation, where these are each complex fields. OK? Yes?
Sorry, I'm just not quite clear on how charge under the transformation comes about.
I'm going to write that down in just a moment. So the way you always analyze these things, this is a good way to start here, is to write down the covariant derivative of the gauge fields acting on the matter field. And so let's write that down for this theory. So d mu phi is equal to d mu phi minus ig a mu a tau a. As in the previous lecture, tau is sigma over 2, and it's the properly normalized generator of SU2. And then minus ig prime times b times 1/2. Sorry, these things all act. So this is the covariant derivative that you would expect in an SU2 gauge theory. This is the covariant derivative that you expect in a U1 gauge theory. If I have the product group, then both vector bosons appear. The charge goes there. In principle, I could suck the charge into G prime if I wanted to. That's a convention. This is my convention. G and G prime are independent coupling constants, and the theory will be gauge invariant for any of the relative values of G and G. OK, Now, once again, I'm going to assume that phi has some potential. I'm going to assume that phi is again called the Higgs field. Phi gets a vacuum expectation value. And once again, I can orient that vacuum expectation value in any direction. So let's orient it so it occurs in the bottom component of the spinner. And once again, this is just a matter of convention. I'll get physically equivalent. I'll get a physically equivalent description if I orient phi in any other direction. OK, let's now compute the kinetic energy term for the Higgs field in the presence of this vacuum expectation value. So now we get the following thing. We get phi star. Then we get the complex conjugate of this. Let me write sigma over 2. Then we get that thing itself. And then we get phi. And for the expectation value of phi, why don't I just put the explicit value? So now there's a little matrix product to work out. So now what I hope you can see is that sigma 1 squared is 1, and sigma 2 squared is 1. And the cross term between sigma 1 and sigma 2, sigma 1 and sigma 2 anti-commute, is going to drop out. And so the 1 and 2 terms are going to look like this. A half times g squared, there's a half here, so there's a 4. There's a v squared. And I'm going to get a1 squared plus a2 squared. And those are all the guys that raise you up or lower you, raise you up here and lower you here. And then the guys that keep you at the same level are the sigma 3 and the b term. And they're going to get mixed together. And so then we'll get another term, which is A3. Oh, sorry, and there's a G. Oh, maybe I should have kept the G in here. There's a G here, there's a G here. Here there's going to be a minus G, and then plus G prime B. And so that's the result. And so again, you see that there's one vector boson that remains massless. But now there are three vector bosons that get mass. This is what we had before, which I wrote up here. Yeah, it's still there as charged vector bosons. And then there's also this one's going to turn out to be a neutral vector boson. So let me try and formalize this a little. This equation can be just like in the Georgi Glashow model. I get another massive vector boson, which is called Z0, which from that equation is G A mu minus G prime B mu over. And then properly normalizing the kinetic term, I have to do that. And then the boson orthogonal to that we'll call A mu. And that would be this one. So now I've made a change of basis among the three, the vector bosons. So these two guys are massive. This one is massive. This one is massless. The masses are mw is equal to gv over 2, or like that. So that's apparent here, gv over 2 squared. And for the z, I get a slightly higher mass, v squared over 2. And when I put in this normalized combination, I'm going to get g squared plus g prime squared. Okay. And this guy is massless. And if there's a massless boson, that means there has to be a symmetry in my original symmetry group, which is unbroken. And it's pretty easy to figure out what that symmetry is. If I act on phi with e to the I alpha sigma 3 over 2. So that's an SU2 transformation. If I then act with e to the plus I alpha over 2 with the U1, this is the transformation e to the I alpha over 2, or alpha rather, times 1, 0, 0, that only acts on the phase rotation of the top component. And then I didn't give the top component of phi an expectation value. So this is still a good symmetry of the theory. So out of the SU2 cross U1 symmetry, there's one combination, namely this one, which is still a symmetry after the Higgs field gets this expectation value. And therefore, there will be one vector boson that remains absolutely massless. And the others get the masses which I've computed. Yes?
There's two complex
Higgs fields? There's one complex Higgs field. Okay. You can have as many as you want, but let's start with one. Okay. If you have two complex Higgs fields, you'd better make sure that their expectation values are aligned in such a way that I don't destroy the symmetry. Otherwise, all four bosons will become massive, and you'll ruin a lot of the good properties that I'm about to discuss. Okay? And the same comment, of course, applies if you have 15. But you could have 15 if they're all lined up. Okay. Good. So now, obviously with this structure, it's going to be incredibly convenient to make the following definition. Let me define an angle theta w. So the cosine of theta w is equal to g over g squared plus g prime squared. And the sine of theta w is equal to g prime over g squared plus g prime squared. So that cosine squared plus sine squared is equal to 1. So there is such an angle. So now that angle appears here. This is the cosine, sine, sine, cosine. So that's exactly the angle of the rotation in the space of fields that I've done to go from A3 and B to Z and A. And probably it won't surprise you to know that this parameter that I called SW yesterday is actually the square of the sine of theta W. And so we'll see that in just a moment. In terms of these relations, there's an interesting relation between MW and MZ that I'm going to use later. Let me write it down over here so we don't forget about it. MW is equal to MZ times the cosine of theta w. Okay. Now I've written the covariant derivative on the Higgs field. So now we can analyze how these vector bosons couple to fermions by writing the covariant derivative on the fermion fields. So d mu on some fermion field is equal to d mu psi minus ig a mu, and then in whatever representation the fermion is. And then similarly, for the U1 field, we're going to have to put some charge. And I'm going to call that charge y. Yes.
Factors of 2 work out with the MZ and MW?
This should be a 4. That should, so these should be the same factor. See, if I didn't have any G prime, the masses would be degenerate. Right? If you didn't have G prime, you get the same mass for the Z and W. So the factors all have to work out. And there's just this extra piece here. So thank you for correcting that. OK, so these symmetries, or these quantum numbers, are given a name. This one, SU2, isospin is SU2. So the usage is that this is called weak isospin, not to be confused with the isospin I told you about before. And this quantum number here is called hypercharge. Okay, and that just happens to be what these things are called. Okay, so now we can write down the, yes?
Your
bracket of that one, then partial d mu phi.
Good. Okay. So now we can write down the coupling of any fermion to these fields that I've introduced just by specifying their quantum numbers. For every fermion, if I tell you what weak isospin it has and what hypercharge it has, I've specified its coupling. And I can do this for Dirac fermions, but actually it's going to be very nice to do it for chiral fermions. So let me assign, then, weak isospins and hyperchargers to all the chiral fermions. And those come in various varieties, U, D, E, nu, etc. OK, the first thing I'd like to do is that I'd like to assign the left-handed particles, U and D, and nu and E, to spinners, doublets of weak isospin, and the right-handed particles, UR, DR, and E minus R, to singlets of SU2. Now, this has an immediate advantage. It tells you that for these guys, this term doesn't appear. The T, the generator of SU2, is zero. Are invariant under SU2. That means that these guys couple to A1 and A2, but these guys do not couple to A1 and A2. So just by writing this, that these guys are in doublets and these guys are in singlets, we immediately see that these W bosons here couple only to the left-handed components of the quarks and leptons. So we build into the model the V minus A structure that's in the weak current. Yes?
Is there any inherent reason why we couldn't postulate the existence of some right kind of particle that isn't in the singlet state?
People do that all the time. We just haven't found one yet.
OK. But it's not like forbidden?
No, it's not forbidden. Okay. No, this is a choice which is entirely based on trying to get that answer. As I said, there are lots of weak interaction models. I just showed you another one that's wrong. We now want to find the one that agrees with the real world. OK, then we should assign some hypercharges to these things. And to figure out how to do that, let me continue to analyze this equation. So what I'd like to do now is let's think about the A3 and B3. So let me just think about the neutral part of this. If these are doublets, this guy here is tau 3, which is sigma 3 over 2, which means that I'm also assigning these guys, by this choice, a weak isospin quantum number. So in particular, the up quark has weak isospin, which I'm going to call I3, equal to plus a half. And the down quark is now assigned a weak isospin I3 equal to minus a half. And the right-handed up quark has I3 equals 0. The right-handed down quark has I3 equals 0. And similarly for the leptons. OK. So now what I'd like to do is to plug the inverse of these transformations in for A3 and B, and we'll rearrange this formula. So this is going to be d mu minus ig times, it's going to be g, well, let me do it this way, cosine theta w z minus sine theta w a, and I3 appears here, and then g prime. And it'll be sine theta w times z plus cosine theta w times a times y. OK. Now, g, of course, is itself the cosine of theta w times the square root of g squared plus g prime squared. And this is similarly the sine. So we're now getting something here where I could have cosine squared plus sine squared if I would just manipulate this a little. So let me do that. So let me write g squared plus g prime squared z mu. So now I could have cosine squared plus sine squared if I borrow a term from here. And so let me write this as I3. And then here there's a sine squared. And there's a y. And then I borrowed an I3. So now we get this expression. And similarly, that times that is cosine times sine. And similarly here. So we get minus I g squared plus g prime squared cosine sine times a mu times I3 plus y. And now let me write some definitions and motivate them. I'd like to write E is equal to the square root of g squared plus g prime squared times cosine times sine, which is equal to g g prime over the square root of g squared plus g prime squared. And I'd like to write q is equal to I3 plus y. OK, so why did I do this? Well, A is the massless vector boson in the theory. So that's the natural thing to associate with the photon. The W's are massive. The Z is massive. The photon is massless. We have one massless gauge boson in the theory. This must be the photon. Its charge, let me collect all these things, must be E, the standard unit of electromagnetic charge. And whatever sits here must be the numerical charge of that particle. And so that's why I've called it Q. So now we can see how to assign hypercharges to everything. We just assign hypercharges in such a way that I3 plus y is equal to the charge we want. It gives some peculiar values, but we have to live with it. So this guy here, both of these guys have y equal to 1/6. This guy has y equal to 2/3. This guy has y equal to minus 1/3. And maybe I should say for the electron and the neutrino, the y has to be minus 1/2. And for the right-handed electron, the y has to be minus 1. And at this moment, where those quantum numbers come from is a complete mystery. We just have to assign them in order that I3 plus y should be the measured electric charges. Yes?
I'm a bit confused about the relationship between Q and Y.
I'm sorry?
What I'm thinking is Y over 2, alpha charge Y over 2.
Y is equal to 1/2 for the Higgs field. So I put that inside Y. So the Higgs field will have, the Higgs field has Y equals plus 1/2 in my conventions.
What I'm saying is like the relationship between charge, the isospin, and the hypercharge.
Yes.
Q equal isospin plus y over 2.
I'm sorry. This is my convention. It's just a convention. It works. So just hang with it for a moment. Other people write y over 2. Excuse me. Okay. And then I can write this equation, finally, in the following way. For the neutral interaction, it's d mu minus I e q. And for the z interaction, it'll be this factor I wrote in here is actually e over cosine theta w sine theta w. That's a convenient way to write it. I3 minus sine squared theta w times q times the z acting on any fermion in the theory. OK. Well, now we pretty much have exactly the structure that we were looking for. The z couples to this charge, I3 minus sine squared theta w times the electric charge. Please notice that that's exactly what's written here. And so this is a purely left-handed thing. This is the ordinary electric charge. And together, the current corresponding to those is the current, which I've written in this box. The W's will couple, as I've said, to the raising and lowering isospin currents, that is only to left-handed fields. And the A will couple to electric charge. So everything is working. These numbers here I'm going to call QZ. And please notice that the QZs are different for the left-handed and right-handed species. And this will be a major issue tomorrow when we talk about the experimental validation of this theory. And so there's one more equation that I ought to write. When you write down the coupling of the doublets to a W, let me just note that when you make the change of variables, there's a factor of the square root of 2 that comes in here. So the equation actually looks like this. And JMU plus and JMU minus are just the flavor raising and lowering currents that we wrote down yesterday when we talked about the V minus A theory. So actually, it works out very beautifully. When you now start integrating out the W and Z, we're going to get this formula. Let me show you exactly how that works. When I integrate over the W, I'm going to get the value of that diagram is IG over root 2 squared times the W propagator is this. And then I'm going to get the matrix element of J plus on one side and the matrix element of J minus on the other side. Yes? Sorry?
I don't understand the formula at the top of that board. Where's the
mu? I'm sorry. This is acting on, This should be maybe I should have written this one, the sigma plus, and this here is sigma minus. And that acts on UD. And so that, acting on that with a U bar D bar on the other side will give you the curve. Okay, so this diagram will give you this structure. The Z diagram will give you this structure, I G squared divided by root 2 cosine theta W minus I over Q squared minus MZ squared and J mu 3 minus sine squared theta W times the electromagnetic current squared. And because I don't know which side of this diagram I'm on, there's a symmetry factor of a half. And that should be there. Okay. And now, if I let Q squared go to 0, so I consider low energy interactions with respect to the W and Z, and I let, and I remember that MW, MZ, sorry, MW is MZ cosine theta W, then all these coefficients turn out to be the same. So the coefficient turns out to be g squared over 2mw squared. And if I now just associate that with the Fermi constant divided by root 2 times 4, then what you see is that I've actually derived the effective Lagrangian that I was trying to show you as justified, show you yesterday as justified experimentally. And I've also calculated the Fermi constant in terms of the parameters of this theory, namely it's g squared over mw squared. Now, we can also write this, because we know g squared in terms of the electric charge, as e squared over 2mw squared sine squared theta w. So actually, this is getting pretty interesting. If I know what sine squared theta w is, and I know what E is, and I know what G Fermi is, then I can actually solve for mw. And so let's do that. So let me write E squared is equal to 4 pi alpha. Let me remember that alpha runs, so I shouldn't use the value at extremely low energy. I should use the value at the mass scales we're talking about, something like 100 GeV. So the right value to put in here is 1 over 129. Sine squared theta W, I told you yesterday, is determined by the neutrino experiments to be about 0.23. The formula that I get here is MW is equal to 4 pi alpha divided by 4 root 2 G Fermi times sine squared theta W to the 1/2. And MZ is the same thing divided by cosine theta W, which is conveniently written like this. Sine of 2 theta W to the 1/2. And then you can just plug in the numbers. And what comes out is 80.1 GeV and 91.3 GeV. So now you can ask the question, are they there? And the answer to that question will be revealed tomorrow. There's just one more thing I wanted to tell you about this theory, and I think I'm going to steal another minute and tell you. There's one more problem with this theory, and that is that because we put the left-handed and right-handed fermions in different representations, it's impossible to write a mass term for the fermions. So a mass term would be something like M up left, M up upright plus Hermitian conjugate. But please notice that this term violates the gauge symmetry of the theory. It has isospin 1/2 here. It has isospin 0 here. So this term transforms under isospin. And it's not gauge invariant. So at first sight, it looks like it's totally impossible to write down any quark masses or lepton masses in this theory. However, fortunately, the same Higgs boson that solves the problem of mass generation for the vector boson solves the problem of mass generation for the fermions. Let's start with the leptons. We can write an interaction between the Higgs field and the electron in the following form. I take the lepton doublet. It has an isospin index. I complex conjugate it. I dot that into the isospin index of the Higgs field. And I multiply by E right. That's a perfectly gauge invariant interaction. It's a singlet under SU2. The hypercharges are plus 1/2 because it's the complex conjugate of this field, plus 1/2 for phi, minus 1 for E. Those add up to 0. So it has singlet under SU2 and 0 total hypercharge. This is a gauge invariant interaction. If I now put in phi is equal to 1 over the square root of 2v, this turns into exactly what I want. Lambda eV over the square root of 2 times this guy picks out the lower component here. So I get E left bar E right plus Hermitian conjugate. So I get exactly a mass term for the electron, where the electron mass is equal to this new coupling that I've introduced into the theory, times v divided by the square root of 2. I can play the same game for the up and down quarks. So I would write the following equation. For the down quarks, I do it exactly the same way as for the electron. I have a quark doublet, UD. I write Q bar dotted into the Higgs field times the down right. For the up quark, you have to be a little more subtle, but not too much. Epsilon AB times the complex conjugate of the Higgs field is another SU2 singlet. And the hypercharges are minus 1/6 plus 1/2 sorry, minus a sixth minus a half plus 2/3. So that's a gauge invariant interaction. Again, plugging in the value of the expectation value of phi, you get a mass term for down and a mass term for up. Yes?
Can you explain what happened to the neutrino in this?
Oh, yeah, when I put in this, 0 times the neutrino is 0. So you have to get your neutrino masses from someplace else. But neutrino masses are extremely small. I'm ignoring them in this whole course. Excuse me. OK. So now we're happy. We've given masses to everything. It only took this one Higgs field to do it. We've derived the weak interaction effective Lagrangian. And tomorrow I'll tell you about all the beautiful and very precise tests of this theory that have been done at high energy. OK? Thank you. Sorry?